Welcome to the Everyday Investor, and welcome to another week in 2023. Who knows what'll come next? Already, we've all had a go with ChatGPT. Hopefully, we all have. We're witnessing stress cracks within the World Economic Forum. We see that Russia's making another push in Ukraine. And here in New Zealand, we've just farewelled a prime minister. While all this is going on, investor sentiment seems to be bouncing back all around the world. Is it a trap? And is there more pain to come? Or are things cautiously, tentatively getting back to normal? Time will tell, of course, because these are curious times. Now, going back 50 to 60 years, when most of our parents would have been diving into the music of The Doors, The Beatles, and The Rolling Stones, it was another curious time. There was a growing desire for change and a rejection of the agendas coming down from the top. It felt in many ways that maybe the end of the world had arrived. Except, of course, it didn't. It just changed a lot within a short period of time, kind of like right now. In 1968, there was a song called 5-1 by The Doors, and according to Song Facts, 5-1 was the approximate ratio of whites to blacks, young to old, and non-pot smokers to pot smokers in the U.S. in 1967. It was also the amount of Vietnamese to American soldiers in Vietnam. Now, perhaps it's true that the ratio of 5-1 or 20% also represents those who hold alternative views. With investing, some analysts estimate that only 3-10% of investors have exposure to alternative investments, though. Are we investing in a way that's authentic to ourselves here? Should we be more open to the world of alternatives? What is an alternative investment, though? Well, basically, anything that's not mainstream is alternative. So cash, bonds, bond funds, property, infrastructure, and publicly listed companies either directly or through some sort of fund. These are mainstream investments. Anything else? Well, there's a good chance it may dance to a different tune compared to the majority. They're the different ones, often misunderstood, and if they had feelings, they may feel a little bit marginalized. So why do we want to consider alternative investments? Diversification and a chance to get an outsized return are a couple of reasons, but there's a few more that we'll discuss today. In the Doors song already mentioned, there's a part in it that says, "You must have whiskey over wine." Now I think if Jim Morrison was alive today and investing, he'd be heavily into alternatives, including whiskey and wine. He'd be self-medicating with it, of course, no doubt. But here's a clue, I think, about how to grow wealth in the future. The more wealthy people there are, the more people there are to drink. And the more anxiety around the present age there is, the more likely investing in fine wine and whiskey could make a lot of sense. Like many investments, you can diversify at a fractal layer. What I mean by this is even the same investment like shares in Apple can be held directly through an index fund and even traded. The same asset held through different hands unlocks a dimensional return. You could invest in a company like Anheuser-Busch, for example. Not that you should, of course. I'm not saying you should. Or you could invest in Vice, an exchange-traded fund that invests in alcohol companies, among other things. Again, not that you should. But you could also buy a distillery or participate in crowdfunding opportunities or perhaps even invest in a cask of whiskey. Same asset, held in different ways to provide a sense of diversification even though you're quite concentrated and increase the possibility of outperformance. Now, personally, I'm not a massive fan of alcohol, and for others that aren't huge consumers, you should still listen in and try to remember there's more people with a lot more money out there in the world than there ever used to be. More people with more money, and they're actively looking for nicer things to spend it on. The struggle's real, right? And I know this evokes a lot of envy in us, but placing that aside, you can start to see the investment logic behind investing in the luxury space. Now, if you've listened into episode 231, the slow cook passive property profit strategy, I'll link to it in the show notes, then you know what I'm talking about around how and why this works with property. Today, it's kind of an extension on that, so I've linked to that episode, and you may want to check it out in the notes afterwards. The headline's simple, though. The growth in the luxury market may continue to grow despite a gloomy economic outlook. Maxwell Nee from Ueno is my guest today, and we're talking about fine wine and whiskey investing. As part of your due diligence, do check out the link to Oweno in the show notes if you want to learn more about how they work. But the usual disclaimers very much apply here when I'm talking about alternative investments like gold, Bitcoin, free speech, and whiskey. So please do a lot more research before going any further. And while you're at it, please do consider if investing in this space violates any of your own ethical investing standards that you've chosen to adopt. Now, that's it for me. I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. I think you will. And I hope that you have a great week. Cheers. You're listening into the Everyday Investor Podcast, passive investing, property investment, managed funds, and crypto. If you're an everyday person wanting to build new wealth for the new world that you're heading into, then this podcast is for you. I'm Darcy Ungaro, your host. I'm a qualified financial advisor, but I'm still learning how to invest better and teach others how to do the same. I talk with guests and cover a range of topics designed to get you to think for yourself here. But please keep in mind, this can't be considered financial advice. Be sure to do your own research here and seek qualified advice of your own before making investment decisions. If you want more information, check out the show notes in your podcast player and make sure that you've subscribed to YouTube also. Then follow the Everyday Investor on all social media channels. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast receives support from the following partners: Easy Crypto, the safe and easy way to buy and sell crypto in New Zealand; Gorilla Technology, increasing business success through innovative and strategic IT solutions; Ungaro & Co. financial advice for everyday people building everyday wealth. Hope you enjoy the show. Let's get started. Okay, thanks very much for joining me on the Everyday Investor Podcast. I'm with Maxwell Nee. How are you, Max?
Hey, mates. I'm good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Today's podcast, we're talking about wine and whiskey. And it's pretty interesting. So why don't you describe to our audience, I'll give you the opportunity just to explain what you do and what your passion is and why you're involved in the wine and whiskey investment industry.
My name is Maxwell Nee. I'm the managing partner of Oweno. So Oweno is a wine and whiskey investment firm in London. Been around for about 9 years now. And the firm is a really, really forward thinker. And then that's what the whole industry is about. You know, the whole industry of alternative investments is about forward thinking and trying to get ahead of the market. You know, everyone knows stocks, property, shares, and that sort of thing. I actually used to work in banking, so I'm very familiar with all that sort of stuff, banking, finance, investments. And, you know, I fell in love with these assets because, you know, two reasons. There's like the passion side of wine and whiskey. When you look at the fundamentals, they are really, really simple. You know, you're looking at things that are in limited supply. Everyone wants them. Therefore, the price is driven up in addition to they increase in value as they age. You know, because if you ever go out and try, for example, a scotch that has zero age compared to a scotch that is, and when I say scotch, I mean scotch whiskey, zero age compared to something that is aged 30 years, the taste is just, you know, completely out of this world, non-comparable. So that's a little sort of insight into how these assets appreciate and how you can, you know, make money with them.
Okay. And I want to get into the differences from mainstream, because we're obviously clearly in the alternative investment bucket, and there's a whole set of things that wine and whiskey investment probably have in terms of characteristics automatically. But before we go there, do you want to just provide a high level picture of what makes investing in wine and whiskey different to traditional mainstream investments like stocks, property, infrastructure, fixed interest, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So I'll give you the bullet points and then I'll tell you a story, right? So the bullet points are: the numbers show that for capital preservation, non-correlated returns to the market, so non-correlated to, you know, stock shares and whatever have you, inflation beating yields, even alpha generating arbitrages, also like downside barriers to these type of investments, they all exist with wine and whiskey. And, you know, one of the key sort of fundamentals that has that attributes all those five things is that when we talk about wine and whiskey assets, we're talking about investment grade wine and whiskey. So the market's about $400 billion worth, US dollars, right? Investment grade is the top 1%. So you're looking at about, you know, $4 to $5 billion of these assets. And you've got to understand, who are these assets enjoyed by? you know, these assets, because they're in the top 1%, they're classified as luxuries. So they're enjoyed by people who enjoy luxurious things, people who are in the mood to spend more money, people who are in the mood to enjoy themselves, in the mood to celebrate. And all of a sudden, when you're in that type of mood, you know, price doesn't really matter as much, you know. And these types of people who enjoy these assets, because these are alcohol and they're, you know, passions and their artistic forms as well, because you can appreciate it for the art form of making wine and making whiskey. It really is a luxury that people love to pay for. And, you know, a great proof of concept is, for example, Bernard Arnault, I think that's how you pronounce his surname, the CEO of LVMH, has just become the world's richest person in a contracting economy. You know, he's at the head of the spear of the luxury world. And the luxury world is booming, even though the whole world economy is contracting. So that just sort of proves the concept of the luxury economy is its own economy, and the assets that we're talking about sit in that economy.
Right. And that's interesting, right? Because I've often wondered that as we mature in the world, mature, I don't know if that's a word to describe the world, feels like we're getting more immature, but as we mature theoretically in the world and as more wealth gets mined from this planet and it accrues within a smaller subset as a percentage, there's still a larger nominal amount of people that have a lot more wealth than the world has ever seen. And exactly. Naturally, they're going to look for ways to burn their money because they know that their life on Earth is finite. And if they don't spend it, somebody else will. So I guess it makes sense that the luxury market is really expanding. How much of that, though, is a function of where we've come from, in your view, with banks like central banks expanding their monetary base? Like, how much of that is just because of money printing, easy money of the last 2 or 3 years especially, versus just the world naturally getting more and more wealthier?
Yeah, great question. So there's a few things that happen in that. You know, for example, COVID was phenomenal for wine, whiskey, and the luxury world. It was phenomenal because when you're sitting at home and you usually have 20% of your income allocated to a holiday or whatever have you, you're not spending that money on travel anymore, hotels. So you basically moved all this spending from travel, hotels, planes, taxis, Ubers, whatever, and moved it into the sit at home on your couch scrolling through Instagram, what should I buy bucket, right? Mm. And the things that people generally buy are things that they don't need, right? So you like new shoes, new bags, you know, and you're also sitting at home ordering Uber Eats, right, instead of eating out. So you're saving money there. And where does that money go into? It's like, okay, well, if I'm going to order Uber Eats, then I might as well order a nicer bottle of wine or a nicer bottle of whiskey to just drink and sit at home and talk and spend time with the family. So what we saw happen was that during COVID, for example, in the wider whiskey world, people's tastes changed, you know, because they started to upgrade themselves up the menu because they had a bit more discretionary income to spend. And once you move yourself up the taste palette of, you know, nicer alcohol, it's hard to go back. You know, it's a bit like flying first class from, you know, New Zealand to New York 5 times in a row, trying to go back down to economy. You know, it's not an easy thing to do.
I've never tried that experiment. Let's try that.
Exactly, right? But you can imagine how you'd feel. And that's how the world is feeling towards, you know, all the discretionary, you know, sort of lifestyle upgrading that they did during COVID, sitting at home, nothing else to spend their money on.
Yeah, it's so strange. And especially as we are heading into 2023 with inflation really starting to be felt, and definitely interest rates, if you have debt, that's starting to be felt. It doesn't feel so much like 2023 will contain the abundance of surplus income like it has in the last few years. But is it true, though, to assume that would spill over into the luxury investment space and it would cause that to pull back a little bit? Or are the type of wealthy individuals that really consume these luxury goods more or less kind of totally, and they don't care about that whole interest rate and mortgage thing anyway? That doesn't affect them anymore. Is that the right way to look at this? Or is this, because we're just talking about the 1% here, aren't we? More or less.
Yeah. So, you know, 1%, top 10%, you know, however you look at it, right? So let's look at it this way. Inflation is a good point because inflation is in the news everywhere, you know, double digits, almost double digits all around the world, right? The way I think about inflation is that inflation is like a wave. It's like a tidal wave. It's like a tsunami, right? And there's two things that happen when a tsunami comes into shore. You're either on the side that gets wiped out from the tsunami, or you're on the riding side of the tsunami. You know, you're riding the wave. So these luxury goods, whether it's Ferraris, handbags, diamonds, wine, whiskey, diamonds are a great alternative investment as well, colored diamonds, you know, paintings, art, classic cars, they all ride the wave of inflation. So they're on the selling side of inflation, not on the buying side. So what that means is that they just basically get to, you know, high inflation is a very exciting time for your wine and whiskey investments. High inflation, you know, might even do you a lot of favors, right? Instead of it choking the affordability, it's just absorbed, and it's a good reason to put your prices up. You know, it almost justifies the business model for that year. If Bloomberg puts out an article, 9% inflation in the US, you can almost bet at that financial year, all these luxury brands will put up their price because they're like, oh, well, now as good a time as any to increase the price by even more because we already know people are going to pay for it. And it's the consensus in the market.
And there was a Knight Frank report. I think I read that over the last decade, we saw 14% average compounding growth in this sector, in the wine and whiskey space, I believe it was.
Yeah.
And like, that's quite phenomenal when you look at the S&P 500 index, right? Like over, I guess, even over a longer time frame. What does that tell us? Because obviously a bottle of wine is not necessarily going to improve the world. It might improve somebody's happiness, but it's not necessarily going to add more value. There's not like a really huge positive spillover into the entire world. So whereas investing in a company that's actually producing something and innovating and employing people, well, that kind of feels a little bit better, doesn't it? Rather than just something that's kind of self.
Yeah, yeah. I'll put it to you this way. You know, so in the Knight Frank Index, rare whiskey has gone up 427% over the last 10 years, right? As of the most recent one. There's a new one due to come back because we're in the new year. You know, whiskey hasn't become 428% more tasty, right? It hasn't become 427% more useful, more appreciated, more whatever. But what has happened is that, you know, really simply, I'm not a mathematician. This is very, very broad, high-level entrepreneurial speak. The market of drinkers has increased by at least 427% over the last 10 years. So if you think about these assets, where do these assets come from? Fine wine and rare whiskey. When I say fine wine, I basically mean wine that has an ability to age, which means that the palate of the wine changes as it gets older, which means that there's almost like an art form of, you know, when's it going to taste the best? That's when we want to drink it. These assets all pretty much come from Europe. You know, whiskey was invented in Scotland, then shared with the rest of the world. You know, fine wine comes from multiple parts of Europe. You know, French is the one that's sort of really done a lot of favors to fine wine in terms of giving it a really great brand. And say 25, 50 years ago, the vast majority of the world didn't really drink fine wine or rare whiskey. So you're talking about, and the population of Europe right now, it's only about 500 million. You know, it's not a lot. And that's all kind of, that's like 36 countries put together. So what we're talking about is in the last 20 years, especially, populations like India, China, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the US, Latin America have all started drinking fine wine and rare whiskey in mass. You know, like it's accessible to the masses, and people like the taste and they want to drink it. They want to drink more. You know, they want to know why the expensive bottle tastes more than it costs more. They want to know the difference in taste between the expensive bottle and the cheap bottle. So they're willing to give things a try. So you're looking at least a 10x in the consumable market for these goods. but absolutely not a 10x in the production of the supply. You know, the supply is pretty much the same. So you're looking at 10x demand with very, very limited supply as you know, very loose example.
So we're kind of talking about like a stock to flow example here, aren't we? Like the amount of new stock that's able to be produced isn't keeping up with the growth rate in the market and the depth of the pockets that that market now has. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So it's right in the wave of, you know, imagine, yeah, there's only so much land in Sydney, Australia, but everyone wants to move there. And that's basically what's happened over like the last 20, 25 years. And there's still more to come. You know, like there's trade restrictions between like Australia and China. So there's a lot more wine that could get to China that isn't getting in there. There's a lot more wine they want to drink that they're not getting. You know, there's investment restrictions in places like India. So it's not easy to sort of set yourself up in India to get your stock in there, to sell it and people that want to drink it. So there's more population that wants to suck up this limited supply yet to go.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like when I put this side by side with, say, holding crypto, some crypto assets, you're looking at the supply and you're looking at the tokenomics just to see how, what rate does it earn or get lost? And is it a fixed supply or is it infinite? But here we've got this luxury good, which can be bought, it can be stored. And then eventually it is finite in terms of its supply. Each one of those units will be consumed, I guess, presumably.
Yeah. Or lost. And then the cycle starts again. Right? Yeah. 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 So it's like this beautiful life cycle of, you know what? Okay. So I want to, when people invest in, think about investing in wine and whiskey, they think of like a graph, you know, a graph where you have this line that just goes up and it keeps going up. As long as it keeps going up, everyone wins. That's not how we take on investing in wine and whiskey. Yeah, that's almost like how people, you know, it's a bit like watching that crypto, the Bitcoin graph, you know, it's like, oh, if it keeps going up, then everyone wins, right? No, that's not what we do in wine and whiskey. What we do is basically we want to buy you in young, you know, at year zero or whatever, so that you can ride the appreciation of the aging of the asset. Because it's when the asset ages that that you receive a significant uplift. And I'll tell you a story about this. So I was in Chicago, meeting an old friend, haven't seen him in a long time. And we go to this bar, which is, you know, really, really cool. There's like live dancing. There's like, you know, acrobatics, like this woman that turned herself into a pretzel, you know, like really, really.
Tell me it wasn't Hooters, Max.
No, it wasn't Hooters, you know, okay. That doesn't happen at Hooters, right? so we get tables at this bar, right next to the stage, and they say, look, you can sit here, there's two seats, but the minimum spend $75 a seat. I'm like, okay, cool, you know, we're on holiday, let's do it. So $150 between the two of us, right? And then I said, you know what, I want an old fashioned. So an old fashioned is a drink that's usually made with bourbon, a cocktail, and I like to have a whiskey, because you know, I have a whiskey as well. And the guy said, would you like Macallan 12 or Macallan 18? And then I said, you know what? I'm on holiday, screw it. Let's do 18. And the difference between Macallan 12 and Macallan 18, Macallan's like the, you know, the apple of whiskey, Scotch whiskey, is that it's the same liquid, exactly the same, but 18 was aged an additional 6 more years, right? Now, the drink came out. It was delicious. I've never had Macallan 18 before. Gave it to my friend. He drank like half the cup and I'm, you know, about to finish his glass. And then I asked the guy, how much was this again? What was the price of this? And he said, $125. I said, no, not how much we spent so far. Like, how much is this glass here? And he said, $125. And I said, no. Not how much is the bottle or how much is, you know, whatever you're thinking. How much was this glass? And he said, $125. And my friend sitting over there laughing at me and like, you know, almost like spitting at me from how much he's laughing at me. And I thought, wow.
He's spitting the whiskey back at you,
hopefully. hopefully. So I paid $125 plus tip for this drink, right? Macallan 18. And then I said to him, okay, you know, I'm committed now. We've basically blown out our budget because we thought we're never going to hit that. That $75 per person. We blurted it out. And I said to the guy, so out of curiosity, how much was the Macallan 12? And he said 25. And I thought, wow. So a difference in 6 years of aging for the end consumer of this luxury good is 500% return. Right? So that's the power of aging appreciation. You can't cheat time, and how these drinks are appreciated. And for shits and giggles, I ordered the Macallan 12 to taste the difference. And it was horrible. Yeah, it was horrible compared to the 18. My friend drank it and he's like, wow, that's such a big difference. So there's a intrinsic value of the difference and also what people will pay, right?
Sure. So correct me if I'm wrong. I have a very limited understanding of spirits and wine, but yeah, when you are aging whiskey, it only really improves with age if it's in the cask, not in the bottle. Is that correct?
Yeah, great question. So whiskey only sort of refined itself and matures in the cask. That's because when you take it from the cask to the bottle, the alcohol content is so high, like 40%, minimum 40%, that the alcohol content acts as like a natural preservative and sort of freezes it in time of its aging once it gets into a glass bottle. Wine is a little bit different. Wine's alcohol content is much lower. It's usually less than 14%. And because wine has a different construct, it can actually, it's one of the only substances on earth that can still age in the bottle. That's why you'll have people that have wine cellars and they've got bottles that they never drink, because it'll taste different, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Sure, I get it. So I guess now we have a bit of an insight as to why wine and whiskey, because it kind of feels like, well, just pick one and be done with it. But already you have diversification at the level of the subtype here, where we have whiskey and wine. Whiskey ages in the cask. Wine can age and improve in the bottle as well. Slight difference. I'm sure there's pros and cons around that. But when you are now thinking as an investor, not just as a consumer, when you're thinking as an investor, you've mentioned kind of a little bit already around this, but what are some of the characteristics that one would look for as an investor with whiskey and wine when they're trying to, I guess, buy the right stuff so that they get the biggest return later on?
Yeah, great question. So the first thing I would say is the top 1% of investment grade wine and whiskey, you don't want to pay retail price for it. Because if you pay retail price for it, you know, who are you going to sell it to? And you're going to sell it to them at retail price. So you started really, really far behind the starting line. It's very, very hard to then catch up and jump over. So you want to work with an investment firm, an investment broker, to help you source stock at wholesale price. Now, you've got to ask yourself, why would they give you stock at wholesale price when they could just keep it themselves, sell it themselves and make money? They will only help you to source stock at wholesale price if they help you to source it, for example, at year zero. So, you know, we spoke about Macallan 12. It gets into the bottle at 12. If you can just get your hands on that year zero, very loose numbers, high level, let's say year 12, the value is $100. At year zero, because it has an age gem, because there's time that needs to happen and all that sort of stuff, you could probably get that at like 20 cents on the dollar. So that $20 to then be worth $100 when it's at its peak maturity, as an example. So that's how the valuation of the appreciation cycle works in terms of how the assets mature. You also don't want to buy retail, because when you buy retail, say from like a bottle shop, you know, your local bottle shop, you're not just buying the stock, you're also paying for the local sales and alcohol tax, right? You know, sales and alcohol tax, the highest in the world. For example, Australia's sales and alcohol tax is 49%. You know, so you buy a bottle for $100 from Europe. By the time it hits shelves at the local supermarket, it's $149 minimum, right? Now, you want to work with a wine investment, whiskey investment broker that can help you buy stock, what's known as under bond. So under bond means that it hasn't entered the consumer market yet, and it's pre-sales and alcohol tax. So you're buying the assets for their true value, not burning, you know, 49% of your cash towards the government, which means that because you've got that asset for its true value, you can exit it anywhere in the world, to Spain, Australia, US, Canada, England, France, wherever. And what that does is that it gives you, you know, a lot more buyers who want your product, which then allows you to ask for the highest price.
Okay, this is really fascinating for me because I'm not really into alcohol myself. It's not really my gig, so consequently, I don't really take much of an interest in this sort of thing. But just thinking about this from a life cycle, rather than looking at a graph where the value goes up and then you just
it's a life cycle. This is the example I give to people. It's a bit like, don't think of it as you're going out there to buy a house and hoping the price goes up. You're going out there to buy a fixer-upper. You know, you've got the best street. You know, you're buying it straight on Main Street in, you know, central CBD or whatever, downtown, on the best street possible, but it's dilapidated. So you're buying something, renovating it, and then selling it back to the market at a premium. So we're buying something mm-hmm. young that needs a bit of work. All the work is that it needs aging. It's going to store it properly. Then we renovate it, right? Quotation marks. Just let it age. Then we sell it back to the market at a premium.
Okay. And you're being rewarded as the investor because of delayed gratification or delayed consumption in a way. But also, yeah. I guess, how it works from the producer's end. And I'm sure there are, I haven't looked into this, but I'm sure there's models whereby they pre-sell or they take money from people to buy a cask, which is buying a cask, but that's basically how they're funding the production of it. And then depending on how long you want to hold on to that will determine how things go and how much you can make at the end. Is that kind of how there's the symbiotic relationship between, say, everyday investors and that producer?
Great question. Yeah, so a producer will sell to you for a few reasons, right? Because you're probably thinking, why would they do that? You know, why would they just throw away that you know, free money that could be made, so to speak?
Yeah.
They'll do it for a few reasons. The first reason is that they need funding. You know, they might need funding for an expansion. Maybe they want to break into a new country, or maybe it works for their business model to get, you know, $1 million today, $5 million 10 years from now. And, you know, what could they do with that money today for branding, marketing, generate sales or whatever? Hmm. The other reason is that there's just not enough room. You know, like they don't have enough room in their distillery, in their vineyards to hold 10 years worth of stock. You know, you can imagine there's physical space restrictions, right? Because if you're thinking about aging things for 12 years plus, you've got 12 years worth of production that you're storing on shelves somewhere. Do you have enough shelves?
So Oweno, it's Greek for wine. You told me before. What is it? What do you do? Go for it.
Yeah, great question. So Darcy, you know, we're actually quite similar to yourself. You know, like we help people to invest in wine, all that sort of stuff, whiskey. But first and foremost, we really see ourselves internally as an education company. You know, we're out there just educating people on this new, cool, fun, sexy, interesting, yet, you know, very, very lucrative on its own two feet, great fundamentals, asset class. Basically, there's like the investment side. We help people to invest in wine and whiskey and all that sort of stuff. And you can invest in your own private portfolio, or you can invest as part of an investment fund. And then there's also the trade and exit side of the business, where basically we help to find the actual person who's going to drink your bottle. Because the person that's going to actually drink your bottle is the person that's going to pay the most for it, which means that you get the best returns possible, which means that everyone's happy because they're out there celebrating with their friends and family that they've got their hands on this, you know, magnificent bottle of wine or whiskey that's, you know, can't be easily found around the world.
And so is it like a complete end-to-end closed loop? So I'm gathering that Oweno would source, say, a cask of whiskey or a certain amount of wine, and then what? They would verify its authenticity, store it. Is that kind of how it could work?
Yeah. It's a huge enterprise, you know. So we have more than 100 full-time people in 4 continents speaking 6 languages to pull this thing off. So we're out there meeting vineyards, distilleries, face-to-face, you know, most of the time, finding, you know, what we classify as, you know, a great investment grade. There's a few different elements that go into that. Then we help you to store it in a bonded facility where it's independently valued and insured, just like, you know, what, you know, all investments should be. Then bring that back into the market, sell it back into the market at a premium when it's ready to be drunk and someone's ready to pay the highest price for it.
And as we've been having this chat, I've just been thinking about how does this really help the everyday investor if they decided to go down this path somehow. And I'm thinking diversification and negative correlation, or negative correlation. So with diversification here, we're not talking about just another company or even going into property or a little bit of cash. We're talking about something that's quite other, and therefore that diversification characteristic must be quite broad. And that kind of makes sense to me. But when it comes to the correlation piece, can you explain to me how the value of this type of investment moves through economic cycles relative to, say, other types of investments like mainstream stocks and bonds and stuff like that?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, if you look at the last three, you know, financial crises or huge dips in the stock market, like last year, 2020, and also 2008, what you'll see is that the broad, you know, fine wine market, it's just non-correlated. You know, it just sort of like stayed flat during that period. And there's a few reasons for that. You know, probably the easiest reason to communicate is that, you know, whenever you have an asset like crypto or stocks, that's highly liquid, which means you could press a button and sell it today, right? Mm. Because you can press a button and sell it today, you can sell a million today, you know, immediately within seconds. Because it's highly liquid, it also makes it highly volatile. You know, because wine, whiskey is a physical asset, it's going to be physically moved from its seller to its buyer. It requires a selling window, just like when you go to sell a house, you know, you don't press a button and sell your house. Because it's illiquid, it's ironically illiquid in how quickly it could be bought and sold and moved from a buyer to another, it's less volatile. You know, it's not possible to press a button and sell 1,000 bottles of wine. And because of that, it acts as like a downside barrier to its value because it can't be fire sold at mass scale. So there's that. And there's also the fact that, you know, we're talking about a good that is used for celebrations. It's designed to be consumed. It's naturally scarce. You know, like these bottles, you know, imagine if in the world every year we destroyed 100 tons of gold. You know, that's what wine or whiskey is. It's designed to be consumed. It's designed to be destroyed, essentially, which means that the marketplace is always, it's always needing to be replaced because there's a lot that's being taken off the market. And if you think about it, you know, there's 8 billion people in the world. There's 8 billion birthdays every year. So you got 8 billion reasons to celebrate with these bottles one way or another, you know, however 100 million Christmas parties, holidays, weddings. You know, what's the first thing you do at a wedding? What's the first thing you do when you celebrate a new job or promotion? You're doing some sort of action, and usually fine wine or rare whiskey falls into those type of actions.
And so, like, kind of thinking ahead, we talked about inflation and rising interest rates, and we're heading into what might be what some people are calling a bit of a global recession. It could be an interesting time up ahead, but thinking in terms of the actual stock or the actual thing that you're investing in with wine and whiskey investing, are there any sort of promising, apart from the market growing, are there promising regions or varieties or certain blends that you're always thinking about to capitalize to see where that crowd is going?
Yeah. Oh, wow. I love your question, Stassi. So I'll talk about whiskey first, and I'll talk about wine. So in the whiskey world, you know, Scotch whiskey has been around for hundreds of years. The new players on the market, they are what's known as more approachable. And those are things like bourbon whiskey and Irish whiskey. So basically American whiskey and Irish whiskey. Now, by approachable, I mean that the taste of them is a bit more simple. Because it's a bit more simple, it's appreciated by more people. You know, an example of simple is that it's sweet. You know, Irish whiskey is often a lot sweeter than Scotch whiskey, even though it hasn't been aged. And because the everyday palate of most people is like simple, sweet, easy to drink, more people are drinking it, which means that it sells more, which means that supply is standing still and demand is just being picked up by more and more people. And to give you an idea of the world's taste palates and the majority of the population's taste palates for these type of things. For example, there's a stat that I heard And it's that in America, 97% of people that drink wine pay less than $10. And that's not because they don't appreciate it or whatever, or, you know, budgets and all that sort of stuff go into play. But, you know, very broadly speaking, 97% of people, they have a simple palate. You know, they want something that's a bit more fun to drink and a bit more simple to drink. And there's also the affordability aspect as well, right? So what I would look for is like crowd pleasers, you know, things that could be absorbed and consumed by a vast range of people compared to, you know, an elite, small aristocratic group of connoisseurs, right? So in the Scotch world, there's Irish, there's American, that's is booming. You know, there's already a lack of supply. I could send you some articles from Bloomberg saying that, you know, the supply they made 5 years ago that's ready to be drunk now, there isn't enough already. So they can't go back into time 4 years and make more for next year, as an example. So there's like almost like a 5-year forecast of how much undersupplied they are. And then in the wine world, there is a lot of things moving in different places of the world due to, like affordability, tastes, and also people are finding better ways to do stuff in other regions. You know, traditionally, wine investment was just France, not just France, but Bordeaux. But now people are willing to pay more for champagne. You know, people are discovering more, people are discovering champagne more and more. You know, like when you treat yourself to a business class flight, whether it's short haul, long haul, what's the first thing they do? They give you a glass of champagne. You know, when you go to the lounge, what's the first thing they do? They offer you a glass of champagne. When it's your wedding anniversary at a restaurant, what's the first thing they do? They offer you a bottle of champagne or a glass of champagne toast. You know, at a wedding, the first thing you do is the toast and the speeches. And what do? You drink champagne. So, you know, champagne has boomed the last few years because people were finding reasons to celebrate. You know, COVID's over, lockdown's over. I don't need to wear a mask anymore. I can travel now. I haven't traveled in 3 years. So I'm upgrading my flight to business class for the first time, which is, you know, always a great feeling. And in and amongst that, there's regions like Spain, Portugal, you know, and I'll give you an example. So French wines could very easily cost $5,000, right? And you could find a comparable wine, fine wine in Spain, Portugal, Italy for $100. So you've got like a massive ceiling that those wines can go up to that people are already willing to pay that you could, you know, get in front of with the right advisor.
And as we finish up on this one, with every opportunity, there's a risk. With every risk, there's an opportunity. And alternative investments are full of both, I think. So what would be some of the key obvious risks that you think people should be mindful of before or as they're doing their due diligence in this area?
Yeah, so there's about two or three. The first one is probably that, well, the biggest risk is that if everyone stops drinking or buying a whiskey, that means the market disappears. So that's, you know, is that going to happen? When's that going to happen? You know, have your own thoughts about that.
There's too much tax revenue. I doubt it's going to stop anytime soon.
Right? You know, but I mean, if people just all of a sudden said, I don't want to drink anymore, you know, let's ban alcohol. If that happens, then obviously the industry goes away. The next risk is fakes. So because these assets are more or less easier to fake, you know, you're just looking at a bottle and a label in many cases, more or less. You want to work with a firm or an advisor or someone that can authenticate your stock and is willing to put like a promise, like a guarantee that this is real as they sell it to you. And then the third risk is overpaying. It doesn't matter if you're buying 1 million Bitcoin. If you've overpaid for 1 million Bitcoin, you're not buying 1 million opportunities, you're buying 1 million problems, right? Because then it's like, who are you then going to sell it to? So you want to make sure you work with people that make sure that you're not overpaying, because you could very easily move from buying an asset to buying a problem.
I see. So if the market disappears, if there's fraud or fakes, counterfeits in the market, and if you overpay for it, like those are the three big things, the obvious things. And the best solution in your view, like I'm just thinking, well, if I just go down to the bottle shop, you've explained why that doesn't work with whiskey, because it's not really going to be aging much. But if I went to the bottle shop and I bought a case of wine and stored it really well, that sounds expensive, sounds risky. I might not do it right. But when you go to sell it, people are going to look to how it was stored, presumably. So is that why a lot of people that take this space seriously, is that why they often go through third parties like Ueno?
Yeah, because, you know, you want to, there's a thing called provenance, which is, think of it as like a stamp. It's like a stamp that this place has been, this wine, the journey of this wine has been stored in a very, very ideal climate, humidity, temperature, lighting, all that sort of stuff. So that, you know, the person that opens it at the end is opening up a fine bottle of wine instead of a bottle of vinegar, which is what usually happens when wine is not stored correctly.
Got it. I can tell you, I have a few bottles of vinegar in my garage. So
it happens all the time, especially this part of the world. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times that there's some articles and stuff like that. So what I'll do is I'll get you to maybe forward that through to me, and I'll include it in the show notes for our listeners and viewers, and they can do a bit of due diligence themselves starting there and then go out as they should when they're assessing any opportunity. So Max, Nee, thank you so much from Ueno, and hope to catch up with you again soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening into the Everyday Investor Podcast. Like what you've heard, but you want more? Make sure that you've subscribed to our YouTube channel and subscribe to the Everyday Investor newsletter too. The links for everything are found in the show notes that you can access easily by swiping or tapping over the cover art in your podcast player. If you received value in some way, I'd love it if you could take the time to write a review wherever you listen to podcasts, share it with a friend, or think of our show partners where appropriate. Easy Crypto, the safe and easy way to buy and sell crypto in New Zealand. Guerrilla Technology, increasing business success through innovative and strategic IT solutions. And Garo & Co, financial advice for everyday people building everyday wealth. Remember, some investments or strategies discussed on these episodes may result in financial loss. Be sure to do your own research and ideally seek qualified advice of your own before making investment decisions. Hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll catch you next time around.